As you know, we have an endless queue of people coming on the program making predictions of wildly variable merits. Some of them use computer models, some of them seem to delve into the entrails of ours. But I've got a beauty for you tonight, a really interesting fellow. His name is Dennis Altman. He's been an economic columnist for The Economist, The New York Times, and the International Herald Trib, an economic advisor for the British government, a university lecturer, and he's the founder and president of North Yard Economics, and we'll find out what that is in just a minute. The book that he's brought to the Sydney Writers' Festival from New York is Outrageous Fortunes, the 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. And Daniel, first of all, welcome. But before we get into some of the counterintuitive things you have to say, in fact, I said earlier, the heretical things you have to say, what is your prognostic process? How do you go about making some fairly daring predictions?
Well, I think it's actually a really simple process, but it's one that not enough forecasters are using these days. I think too many forecasters are looking at the short term and maybe looking at a string of numbers that come out of the economy, whether it's unemployment or inflation or GDP growth, and they're just using that string of numbers to predict the next number. You can't make good predictions that way because you're, first of all, just extrapolating, and second of all, not understanding the fundamental processes that are driving the economy. So,
but you come up with it. I'm trying to find your phrase. It's a sort of a deep analysis. What's this sort of catchphrase of yours?
I talk a lot about deep factors.
Right, that's the one. What are they?
So deep factors are the things that drive changes in the economy over decades. They're the things that are often so ingrained in an economy that it's very difficult to change them, and they rarely change very frequently. These are things like history and culture that can be reflected in many ways. We've seen research by economists, for example, that looks at the legal systems that were left in place in countries that were colonized by England and France, Germany and others. And these things happened hundreds of years ago, and yet they still have profound implications for those economies today.
And yet they're not often factored in.
That's right. I think people do not spend enough time really understanding those deep factors and looking at the long term when they make their forecasts.
I also undertook to establish what North Yard Economics is. Can you explain your outfit?
Right. So North Yard Economics is something I do mostly in my spare time with my friends from graduate school. It's a not-for-profit consulting firm, and we work only with governments and non-governmental organizations in developing countries to try and build their capacity to do high-level economic analysis.
Okay. Now, there's a lot in your book that would not shock or come as a surprise to our listener, whose name is Gladys, incidentally. But there's some stuff that is, in fact, perplexing, paradoxical, surprising, and I just want to look at one of them. Everyone bangs on about the inevitability of Chinese dominance in this century. You're not entirely convinced.
That's right. I think if you look carefully at Chinese economic growth, you'll see that it's being driven to a great extent by two trends that we're very familiar with. One of them is urbanization. We see people moving off the farms and into the cities where they can work in big factories and service operations and start to climb the skills ladder a little bit. That's one trend. And China's following very much the same arc that the United States did and Japan did in the past with respect to this trend. The second is their ability to copy products that are developed in other countries, perhaps more advanced countries, but manufacture them more cheaply and then export them. And that's a great spur to their growth as well. These two things together, we're very familiar with. You know, the United States and Japan have used them in their growth, but you can only get so much out of them. And you can see that China is probably going to exhaust what it can get out of those trends within a couple of decades. And then the question will be, how well will China compete with other countries that are really at the frontier of economic advancement?
Deep factors. Let me suggest to you that, in fact, China, until comparatively recently, was the great source of ideas and intellectual energy and invention. It went on for thousands of years until suddenly and rather mysteriously it stopped. The list of things that China innovated is formidable. Now, there's the great question as to why this happened, but perhaps China will not simply replicate, do what Japan did post-war. Perhaps China will go back to this ancient, deep tradition of being highly inventive and surge forward in its own right.
I think it's one thing to invent, and it's another thing to innovate. To invent, you need new ideas. To innovate, you need to make sure that those ideas have value and that they're adopted into your economy and into your society. And while Chinese people may still be very innovative, the Chinese economy, because of some of these deep factors, makes it very hard for their ideas to really be incorporated into the economy. And there are a lot of these problems that are built into their business culture and the structure of their organizations.
You also see America effectively bouncing back.
Well, I see some parts of America bouncing back. The way I look at growth...
This will ensure the book's sales in the United States. People will be so grateful to grasp at it.
Well, you know, there's always good news and bad news, and we haven't heard much good news lately. But I think if you look at the long-term picture for the United States, there definitely is some good news. When I look at growth overall, it's sort of like a race. It's almost like a marathon. And there are packs that are running in the marathon, and you can do some things to move up to the front of your pack. But it's very hard to jump into another pack further ahead in the marathon. Now, the United States is probably in one of the furthest forward packs in this great marathon that we have around the world because it has the potential to get some of the highest living standards in the world, and it has often realized that potential.
It doesn't distribute them terribly well these days, does it?
Well, that's one of the problems. You know, one problem is that we've neglected our investments in things like basic research and education and infrastructure. But another problem is that we're not as meritocratic as we used to be. We don't distribute as well as we used to, and that makes it more likely that someone with money is going to get an opportunity rather than someone with talent or a good work ethic or good ideas.
We see the seething sort of energies of the new technologies in America, don't we? We see the little startup companies that grow into Microsofts and Apples, and that won't come to an end in the U.S. in the foreseeable future.
Well, we have one of the best environments in the world for innovation and entrepreneurship. That hasn't changed, and that's something that we really have the edge on in comparison with countries like China and many countries around the world. But it's harder for the people at the bottom who perhaps don't have the resources or the liquidity to follow through on their best ideas because we're starting to see this meritocracy erode. We don't have the social mobility that we used to have.
Okay, two heresies thus far. China is not going to just take over and dominate the way everyone is either insisting or fearing, and the United States ain't finished yet. Somewhere in between those two poles, there's Europe and the EU. What do you predict for that?
So the EU started out in the 50s as an economic union based on some big industries that was supposed to stop France and Germany from getting into another war. And it's grown now into a 27-country bloc where all of these countries are supposed to join together. They're all eventually supposed to join the euro, have a common currency, and have a more and more integrated economy. When you look, though, at the long-term risks and the long-term opportunities for these countries, what you see is they're actually splitting in four different directions. And what's most startling about it is the countries that split in these directions are forming contiguous blocs themselves. So it would be very easy for Europe to simply split into two, three, or four groups of countries that were going in very different paces at different directions towards growth. And I think this idea is actually picking up a lot of steam in the public discourse that there might be a two-track Europe or a three- or a four-track Europe.
One of the points you raise is about the political instability that many countries are experiencing. Well, you know, the last 15 years, Lithuania, 12 changes in the head of government, Latvia, 10, Romania, 9, one loser's count in Italy. We've had prime ministers coming and going at increasing velocity, and your system, of course, keeps presidents in for at least one term. And we also see the pendulum going left to right, back to left again. Where's that heading in your view? What are the implications for this volatility?
So there are a couple topics I'd want to attach to that. The first is the idea of how to get politicians to focus on the long term. Some people say China's very lucky because its leaders know that they'll be there for a while.
And so they can be authoritarian on issues like climate change.
Yeah, and they can make long-term infrastructural investments because they know they'll be around to reap the benefits of that politically. American politicians, Australian politicians, because they have such a short electoral cycle, perhaps they can't. And if you change government very rapidly, then that time horizon gets even shorter, and it's very hard to plan for the future. Why would a politician make a long-term investment that had an upfront cost if they weren't going to be around to reap the benefits, right?
Yeah, so...
So that's one problem.
Well, I agree with the diagnosis. We can all see that. It's a pain in the backside. And the attention span of the media accelerates this tendency.
Absolutely.
Because... You know, most political parties of the shelf life of yogurt, extrapolate from that. Take that 10, 20 years down the track, and where are we?
Okay, so I think there are really only two things that we can do to fix that. One is we can change the structure of our political institutions. Another is we can really change the incentives that are facing our politicians. If we tell them, yes, we know you might not be in office for very long, but we will reward you and reelect you in these short cycles if you plan for the future, then they'll begin to do it. It's just that we're not sending the right message now. And as you say, the media is exacerbating the problem.
Well, that's a lovely idea, but it smacks of the Panglossian or the utopian. How on earth can you get a short-term creature like a politician busting to be re-elected in 3-4 years, how can you get him or her to think ahead? They're not like the English aristocracy that would bring in capability brown and plant a garden. They're not going to see what their great-grandchildren will see.
Yeah, I think it's the question of what the voters are transmitting to politicians. If the voters send the message that they will reward decisions that plan for the long term, then we'll start to see politicians react. But, you know, I'm starting to suspect that voters don't care that much about future generations, that we have this sort of narcissism which breeds a self-centered culture so that we...
Daniel, you're amongst friends saying that. My guest is Daniel Altman, founder and president of Northyard Economics. Talk to me about another one of your themes which runs through a lot of your writing. Talk to me about the notion of convergence.
Well, convergence is almost a technical term that's being used by academic economists. It has been used for some time. And the idea is that countries, as they reach the same level of technology, the same access to ideas and ways of putting things together and ways of managing people, they will reach the same living standards when they have access to the same resources as well. So the idea is that if you have countries with similar institutions, the deep factors like I was talking about before, they will tend to converge in their living standards because the ones that start out with lower living standards will receive more investment, and eventually they'll reach that frontier which sort of sets the limits of their economic potential, denoted by those deep factors. But what we find out is that there are lots of these sort of groups of countries, and they're, like I said, like they're packs in the marathon, and you can sort of reach the head of the pack, but it's hard to jump into the other pack without changing your deep factors.
One of the 12 trends you've written about raises an issue that we've been discussing a lot on the program in the last couple of years, something which you and I would describe as a new form of colonization, where countries sell off their assets up to and including the actual land to sustain themselves in the short term. Incidentally, I should have pointed out, or you should have, that China is one of the countries which has to buy larger and larger tracts of land simply to feed its people, and it may not be able to feed them internally, so it's going to be a big land grabber.
Yeah, I think I did point out in the book that China's losing about 10,000 square kilometers of arable land per year and has to replace that because it's people's demands, even if the population's not growing, it's people's demands for food and other things that can be produced on that land is just growing and growing along with their incomes. And it's a disturbing trend for me because I think that none of these deals that China and Saudi Arabia and other countries cut with poorer countries for their land and resources is going to turn out well.
There are. I've had people on the program, UN representatives, World Food Organizations, arguing that it is beneficial. I'm deeply suspicious of it, as you are, but it's not the only way that that countries sell their assets, is it? It's also the stuff underground, as well as the ground itself.
Well, yes. I mean, there are black markets for just about everything. And sometimes we see problems when countries sell off their assets domestically, too. It doesn't have to be to a foreign power. You only have to look at to see what happened after the Soviet Union collapsed, where opportunistic investors in Russia were able to gain control of some of its most important industries. And the state has ever since been trying to claw them back.
One of the trends you identify is the ongoing process of usurping indigenous land for fun and profit. Now, you're in a country where this has a long and proud tradition, but it's happening pretty much everywhere, is it not?
Well, I mean, we certainly had our experience with it in the United States as well. I think that it's very easy for politicians who are offered a large upfront reward, like a $1 billion check from China or Saudi Arabia, to take over land as needed, push people off the land as they've done in countless Cambodian villages, for example, in order to get that big upfront payoff. Now, this might be okay if they had the long-term interests of their countries at heart and they were willing to provide for the people who were being affected. But we see that neither of those things is really true.
How big a factor is climate change in your scenarios?
Well, you know, I always tell people that I'm an economist, I'm not a climate scientist, and I don't plan things around the scientific forecast that I see for climate change, but I can see what's happening now. And I can see that arable land is being lost, people are being displaced, there's not enough food in some tropical regions, it's harder to get water as well, and this is going to be a source of conflict, it's going to be a source of a lot of unrest in these countries, which will most certainly resonate in the larger economies as well. So I think it is quite important, and it's something that all the economies of the world need to try and deal with.
As we sit here this evening, Daniel, you and I, talking our heads off, a lot of signals about the global economy are extremely bleak. There seems to be another wave of troubles. Well, they're here already. If you live in Spain or Portugal or Ireland or etc., etc. Is there any good news in your scenarios for the medium to long term?
There's a ton of good news out in the economies today because we've just seen in the past couple of decades hundreds of millions of people lifted out of poverty. The number of people who are living at a subsistence level, where they're only growing enough food for themselves and their families to eat, is going to fall as we go forward. The question is, what will happen to these people as they get higher incomes? Will they be able to get all the food that they want to eat? Will they be able to get the water they need? And how will we deal with the demands that they have? And how will we integrate them into the global economy? Those things are complex, and the dislocations that that causes as a process are very complex as well. We don't do a very good job of transitioning from a less globalized to a more globalized world.
You come from a country where the greatest play is called Death of a Salesman, where every American who comes on the program, up to and including Henry Kissinger, is selling. That is the great art form of the United States, is selling. And you see this as very much a part of America's future role.
I do. You know, I said there were some bright spots, and I think one is this great combination of industries that we have, which is built around our commercial culture. And it's something that was really forged in the crucible of early America, where you had people from so many different backgrounds coming together, and you had to find a way to sell to all of them, which was often a sort of least common denominator. But I wouldn't use that term pejoratively. I mean, it's seriously. You had to appeal to them like kittens doing funny things on YouTube, you know? And, you know, people like P.T. Barnum figured out how to do that, and we've really absorbed that into our culture.
So Americans can act as deal makers, as middlemen, as brokers, as energizers by putting together pieces of this great economic puzzle.
Yeah, it's not only that we have this great commercial culture, which was just purpose-built for globalization because it's meant to appeal to people no matter what language they speak, no matter what culture they're from, but we also have so many people who bridge more than one culture, and they can act as gatekeepers across cultures, across countries, borders, all over the global economy.
How's your book being received in the United States?
Well, I think there are, as I said before, definitely people who are eager for some bright spots, and they like to hear that. The United States, though, has been crazy with the China story, and to have someone come out and say, actually, maybe China will be the biggest economy in the world for a while, but then the U.S. might pass China again, that's something that definitely gets people to think a little bit.
Okay, before I let you go, some of the solutions you have are lengthen the terms in office. In the US, make it 8 years instead of four for the president, and applying that same principle pretty much everywhere. Provide rewards for leaders who institute productive long-term policies, such as the Ibrahim Prize, for example, and to try and change political, social, and economic culture at its roots by generating the next generation of, or educating the next generation of global citizens in a way that emphasizes long-term planning. Is that the essence of your message?
I think it is. I think that we are too focused on short-term gratification. If we would learn to look into the long-term, we'd be grateful for ourselves in the future.
And are you optimistic that this can happen? I mean, it should happen, but can it?
I think it has
given to happen. Given our greed, given our desire for instant gratification, Polly wants a cracker right effing now?
It has to happen because it will be a competitive edge, and the people who adopt this attitude will soon be the leaders.
And you're at the Sydney Writers Festival spreading the glad tidings.
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome. My guest is economist Daniel Altman, and his latest book is called Outrageous Fortunes, The 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy, and it's published by Black Ink. Before I let you go, make a prediction as to the presidential election. You might have heard me discussing the Republicans' dilemma with Shapiro. How do you think it's going to play out?
I think it's extremely difficult to beat President Obama at this point. I thought as soon as he was elected in 2008 that he was sure to win two terms, solely because the economy was likely to have recovered by the time he was up for re-election. The assassination of Osama bin Laden makes it almost a lock.
Almost a lock. Thank you, Daniel Altman. And after a little bit of music from my talented associate, Mr. Goff, we're going to talk to Tim McGurk, who's a former bureau chief for Time magazine, about the life and times of Osama bin Laden's youngest wife, LNL, ABC Radio National, and our various international platforms.